The Olympics are watched by millions of sports fans. But before the games arrive in any host city, there's an enormous transformation that happens. From the Global Reporting Center and PRX, State of Play is a new podcast investigating how the Olympic Games change big cities. This season, we'll take you to Paris, Vancouver, and LA to meet the people who are pushed out and priced out in the name of sports. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban deny women and girls an education, but there are small pockets of hope.
Yes, there are schools. Some of them are secret, some of them not so secret, but the best progress is this quiet progress.
I'm Marco Werman. More today about women's rights in Afghanistan 3 years after the Taliban took over. Also, Indonesia is getting a whole new capital city built from the ground up.
We try to come in with almost 180 degrees opposite of what Jakarta is.
Plus, we'll hear why some Olympic athletes are getting financial rewards and how a geological formation in Scotland presents new insight into our planet's history.
It confirms that these rocks in Scotland are part of the Snowball Earth glaciation some 720 million years ago.
When Earth looked like a snowball and more, today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Friday. We begin today in Indonesia. The capital city there is in trouble. Greater Jakarta is crammed with more than 30 million people, and the metropolis is slowly sinking into the ocean. That's why tomorrow Indonesia is inaugurating a new and improved capital city. As The World's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen reports, it's about as ambitious as national projects get.
Smart Forest City. Menuju Indonesia Maju 2045.
A smart forest city. That's what Indonesia's government calls its new capital, Nusantara. In Nusantara, half the city is covered in trees. People walk or bike to work or take trains run on solar power. Or they even take flying taxis. It's like Copenhagen meets the tropics with a dash of the Jetsons. Or it will be, according to its master plan. Construction started just 2 years ago.
The city is nothing like what we've seen in Indonesian cities today because we start from scratch.
Sibarani Sofian is the lead architect of this new capital. His canvas, a patch of land about the size of Tokyo on Borneo, one of the world's largest islands. Like Australia's Canberra or Brazil's Brasilia or even Washington, D.C., this is a planned capital, expected to cost $38 billion. Nusantara's emphasis on nature is a reaction to Jakarta, a sprawl of hot asphalt, often ranked as the world's most polluted city.
We try to come in with almost 180 degrees opposite of what Jakarta is.
President Joko Widodo is already in Nusantara. At a military ceremony this week, he gathered young Indonesian troops, handpicked from across the country. They'll raise the flag over the new capital tomorrow, making it official. He's already started working from Indonesia's new state palace, a hulking structure shaped like a bird. A mythical bird known as the Garuda, says Sibarani, the architect. It's a symbol of Indonesia.
You know, the last time you see a palace, the shape of animal in the world, probably Egypt during the Pharaoh, right?
Despite its grand promises, for now, Nusantara is mostly a dusty construction site, rebar and concrete everywhere, acres of trees cleared away. Not everyone believes it can ever become a futuristic green city.
Green city is like a gimmick, maybe.
A gimmick, says Fathur Rozikin Finn. He's with the advocacy group Indonesian Forum for the Environment. They've criticized the project for cutting down lots of trees and for moving thousands of locals in that area off their land. Fathur says even though people have been compensated, many didn't want to leave. Some, he says, are indigenous people with deep ties to that soil.
If we ask the community, there is no trust.
I spoke to someone who spent time in that area since the 1980s, Willie Smits, a Dutch-born Indonesian citizen and wildlife conservationist. He's also a government advisor. He thinks other countries should pay close attention to Nusantara and maybe follow its lead.
It's impressive, and it's promising to become a very good example for other places in the world.
As for claims that the area has long had a rich community of indigenous peoples, Smit says that's not true, and that some environmental groups wrongly portray the area as a paradise. He says the place was already an ecological tragedy, with virgin forest mowed down long ago to plant a single crop, eucalyptus trees.
It's a biological desert. There are no wildlife in those eucalyptus plantations. They have been spraying there several times a year with glyphosate, Roundup, and killing everything underneath the vegetation.
Willie Smit says little is lost from turning timber farms into an eco-utopian city with replanted trees. Sibarani Sofian, the lead architect, concedes that Nusantara is mostly a construction site for now. The master plan, with all the slick offices and cafes entirely powered by solar and wind, won't be finalized until 2045.
I think there's a phrase, Rome is not built in one day, or is Paris not built in one day, something like that.
Sibarani says, ultimately, people will determine the success of Nusantara. The government wants it to eventually have a population of 2 million. But will people want to move there and give the capital city life? Well, he says the first wave won't necessarily come willingly.
Movement of the government official is something that can be pushed, yeah? So it's not really an option for the government official to say no.
About 12,000 bureaucrats will settle there by next month. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
A quick update on the ceasefire negotiations and the war between Hamas and Israel. 2 days of talks in Qatar wrapped up today. The participants plan to reconvene next week in Cairo, in Egypt. Israel and Hamas have agreed in principle to a plan presented by President Biden at the end of May, while both sides have accused the other of trying to sink the deal with new demands. But today, the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar issued a joint statement saying this week's meetings have bridged the gaps and should allow for a swift implementation of the deal. We'll continue to follow that news next week on the show. Authorities in Denmark are concerned about a rise in violent crime there. One disturbing part of this trend is that a lot of the violence is committed by children from Sweden who are recruited by Danish gangs. Diamant Salihu is a crime reporter for the Swedish news broadcaster, SVT, in Stockholm. He told us that Sweden is now sending its own police forces to Denmark to intervene.
They're helping the Danes as much as possible with their intelligence about these networks that are involved and all the youths that are being recruited. We are even speaking about child soldiers. And the Danes are obviously doing their best to prevent an escalation and a murder from happening in this specific gang war.
What is the number of Swedish police that will be deployed?
There will be one police from Sweden, as far as I know, deployed to Copenhagen, and one from Denmark deployed to Malmö in the south of Sweden from Denmark, so they can share intelligence very quickly, hopefully prevent an escalation. I know that there are a lot of police officers involved in this on both sides because they take it very seriously.
We'd like to learn more about the operations of the gangs and the kind of problem law enforcement, both Swedish and Danish, are dealing with. Can you explain how Swedish teens are recruited by Danish gangs?
The Danes has a lot of organized gangs, MC gangs mostly, but also street gangs. One of them is called Loyal to Familia. In Sweden, we have also organized criminal groups, but also a very chaotic environment with young people, even young teenagers, recruiting other teenagers. And they're very violent because we have had a radicalization in this environment and a normalization of what kind of violence you can use. And in Sweden, it is very normalized today to use deadly violence, mostly through to shoot somebody or even to detonate bombs outside somebody's home. And if you compare to Denmark, this is not as common. So even the Danish criminals are very worried for this escalation because the organized criminals in Denmark are more like adult people that want to earn money on economic crimes and drugs and that kind of criminality. and not risk their lives. And now they're facing a lot of teenagers and young adults from Sweden that are being hired by Danes, but also by Swedes that are recruiting them on social media with ads on how much they can get for a kill in Denmark.
As someone who has focused on crime in Sweden, Diamant, do you think the Swedish police, realistically, can help out the Danish authorities?
In many of the cases, those that are leaders in these groups, according to the police, the leaders are hiding or staying without any interference from local authorities in countries as Turkey, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, and also Iran. So the leaders can be safe in these safe havens and order the recruiters here in Sweden or wherever they might be and send these child soldiers to kill each other without risking to get arrested at this moment. And that is the major problem. And to deal with that international problem, then we need international collaboration and also an interest from these countries that at the moment are not doing as much.
Diamant Salihu is a crime reporter for the Swedish news broadcaster SVT. He joined us today from Stockholm. In the U.S., 4 out of 5 new cars sold are SUVs or pickup trucks, but there's also something completely different happening in car culture right now. Call it a microtrend of a certain kind of very small car. As GBH's Craig LaMolt reports from Boston, many states across the U.S. are trying to keep these tiny vehicles off the roads.
In his driveway in Quincy, Massachusetts, Ray Moy points to a tiny light blue truck.
This is a Daihatsu Miura walkthrough van.
From the windshield up, it looks like it's been stretched upwards into something just comically out of proportion.
This is like a 1960s miniature like milk truck.
It's one example of a K-truck, spelled K-E-I. It's a class of small Japanese vehicles that are no more than 5 feet wide and 11 feet long. Moy climbs in through the folding doors and sits down behind the steering wheel on what would usually be the passenger side. Moy takes a spin around the neighborhood, and it's a smooth ride. He's clearly having fun and says it's kind of like steering a bus.
What other vehicle can you drive nowadays that would give you the same driving experience?
Moy bought his first K-truck during the pandemic, and since then, buying, selling, and working on them has become a passion. These things can cost as little as $3,000, including import fees. So Moy says it doesn't take Jay Leno money to have a car collection. But then he got a new one recently and hit an unexpected snag.
I tried to register it, and they told me, oh, we can't register this because they're unsafe, so we're not going to touch this.
That's a change. Federal law has long allowed importation of older K cars. But Massachusetts is now pointing out they don't meet federal safety standards. Paul Stiers with the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, which is recommending K-trucks not be registered.
I think the confusion comes then that it's just automatically assumed that if the federal government says it's okay to bring the vehicle to the country, then wouldn't one just expect that I could get a license plate and drive it down the roadway? And it's two very distinct issues.
Importing cars is federal business, but it's up to the states to decide what to register. And several states now have policies banning K-trucks or restricting their use on roads. The Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles did not make anyone available for an interview for this story. But in a written statement, a spokesperson said, quote, the RMV is working to review and assess industry standards related to K-class mini trucks, unquote. The RMV says it'll take into consideration testimony on the issue from K-truck enthusiasts at its board meeting last month. One of those who testified was retired mechanic Artie Chattis.
My T-shirt says, life is too short to drive boring cars.
His Subaru Sambar looks kind of like a smaller VW bus.
It's so much fun, and there's a ton of room inside.
Chattis says right now his registration is still legal.
But no one knows if the registry will revoke our titles and registrations.
Joe Rose drives a little K car with just one seat.
It's a Daihatsu Midget. It's not really politically correct, but it is what they called it.
Rose says if Massachusetts does come to a final decision to stop registering these vehicles, he'll create an LLC business in a state that does register them and just get plates there.
And it's a shame because, you know, Massachusetts is forcing us to do that. They're going to lose the revenue, you know, money every year they're going to get for excise tax, sales tax when somebody tries to register it.
Rose also has some classic cars from the 20s and 30s and points out most old cars don't meet current federal safety standards. So if Massachusetts is going to stop registering K cars and trucks for that reason, he's worried other old cars might be next. A spokesperson for the State Registry of Motor Vehicles didn't respond to a question about that. For The World, I'm Craig LaMolt, Boston.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Our next story takes us way back to when our planet was completely covered in ice. The so-called snowball Earth phase was followed by a thaw and then the first emergence of animal life. Scientists have not had a complete geological record of that time, but this is changing. A study out of University College London points to a rock formation near Scotland that could complete the picture. Elias Rugen is the lead author.
These rocks off the west coast of Scotland, as you say, record this snowball Earth glaciation that covered the entire planet in ice. From outer space, Earth would have looked like a snowball. But we see today the incredible power and erosive nature of glaciations. And back then, that would have been the same, if not even greater, within the snowball Earth glaciation. So therefore, all the rocks beneath the snowball Earth glaciation have been removed from Earth history. So what we have as geologists is we have a missing time gap beneath the snowball Earth. We can't really probe any of those questions of how and why we got into the snowball Earth glaciation. However, in Scotland, we don't have that erosive nature. We have this gradational onset of glaciation where we see kind of warm tropical seas transitioning to early signs of ice and then definitive snowball Earth glacial rocks. So that's what's unique about the Scottish rocks.
So there are places in the United States where geologic time is actually visible, like the layers of rock and schist in the Grand Canyon or the cliffs of the New Jersey Palisades. How do these rocks appear? Can you see the layers of time in them?
Yeah. So the layers of rock in the rock record can be almost read like a book, like the pages of a book. You kind of move through those layers upwards in the record and they get younger upwards. We also have techniques which we apply to the rocks where we can actually get an age constraint and date the rocks specifically. And that's what we've done in Scotland. And that's what this new study shows. It confirms that these rocks in Scotland are part of this snowball Earth glaciation some 720 million years ago.
Yes. So if there's a story to this prehistory that wasn't complete, help us understand how your research has kind of completed the story.
Yeah. So the research that we've produced is in effect some new age constraints for these rocks in Scotland. Previously, we've known they're part of a snowball Earth glaciation. We just haven't known specifically in Scotland how old they are. So our new data places it in a glacial time which lasted between 720 million years ago to 660 million years ago. And that's a 60 million year glaciation. You know, to put that into perspective, that's the same amount of time between us today and the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So it's an incredible length of time for Earth to be covered nearly entirely in ice.
So all of these factors helped you determine that these rocks held this complete record of the time before and after snowball Earth?
Yeah, a combination of kind of observations of the record in the field, visiting the islands and seeing these amazing features in the rock. And then, you know, taking samples back to the laboratory and analyzing them. And that's how we've then come to get these ages for the rocks in Scotland.
With this gap in geologic history filled, what kind of research do you hope will follow now?
Most other places on Earth, this time in Earth history is missing, has been eroded away, you know, has vanished from the record, if you like. So the fact that we have it in Scotland allows us to get at some of these questions of how and why Earth descended into a snowball Earth climate state. It's quite a rare climate state in Earth history. You know, we've only been in a snowball Earth climate state twice, maybe three times in Earth history. So as scientists, we really want to understand why, what happened to Earth to make it kind of descend into this snowball Earth and last for 60 million years. You know, it's an incredible amount of time.
Elias Rugen is a PhD student at University College London. His study is in the Journal of the Geological Society of London. It goes without saying that winning gold at the Olympics is a major accomplishment. Some athletes, though, once back home, get rewarded well beyond that medal. There are even cash prizes. And as we hear from the world's Bianca Hillier, it's led to a debate about financial rewards for Olympic champions.
As soon as Litsile Taboho crossed the finish line and won the 200-meter sprint at the Paris Olympics, people in Botswana started dancing in the streets. Get in, get in, get in, get in, get in. Turns out, those celebrations never stopped. When Toboho returned home this week, more than 20,000 people filled the country's biggest stadium to welcome him back. Toboho himself gave a short speech, thanking the crowd and the government for their support.
For the government for flying my family over to see me do great. I'm grateful for that also.
But that pot of money, it appears, has dried up. The president's office has now asked people to donate to a reward fund for Botswana's Olympians. That is uncommon. What's more typical is for athletes to either get no prize money, like in Great Britain and Sweden, or for them to get a whole lot of cash.
Kong extends. Kong's got it!
Team Hong Kong's Vivian Kong is getting nearly $800,000 for her fencing gold medal. Then there's the Philippines. Pinoy athletes were greeted in Manila this week with parades and a ceremony at the President's Palace. The team's star, gymnast Carlos Yulo, also got $100,000, free food and haircuts for life, and a new place to call home.
Yulo toured his new and fully furnished condo unit, which even has a coffee table designed like an Olympic gold medal. And
another country showering their champion is Pakistan. Arshad Nadeem brought home the javelin gold from the games. He reportedly got nearly $600,000 and two new cars, plus free gas for life. To top it off, his new license plate is 92.97, the distance that won him gold in Paris. Newly minted Olympic medalists are also likely to receive a bonus from their sponsor or an entirely new, bigger sponsor. There's also a brand new money stream for track and field athletes.
World Athletics stepping up and saying, like, hey, we'll pay the athletes is actually huge.
Thea Lafon-Gadsen won gold in the triple jump for the small island nation of Dominica. She's one of the first athletes ever to receive prize money from a sports international governing body. In a first-of-its-kind plan, World Athletics gave every Olympic track and field champion $50,000.
I want to say within like 48 hours after I competed, I had the paperwork in hand. They were very quick with it.
She plans to put the money toward a down payment on a house. This influx of cash came after two Olympics, which she managed by working full time as a teacher.
It was honestly a way to get access to a gym because I could lift in the building in the morning.
But the International Olympic Committee is against these payments. They think sports federations should instead focus on reducing inequalities between countries, not handing out prizes to winners. Lafon-Gadsen thinks the IOC themselves should hand over a check.
Making the Olympics is honestly one of the hardest journeys you could possibly go on for your athletic career. And so I think that if they were just to help out a little bit financially, it would be amazing.
Mark Conrad, a sports law professor at Fordham University, says that's unlikely to happen.
I think it's theoretically possible if there's enough pressure on the IOC in future years to do that. But I think as more and more countries do pay athletes, in a way, the IOC is going to say that is being taken care of by various countries if they wish to do so.
Thea Lafon-Gadsen says she hasn't yet received any bonuses or gifts from Dominica since her win, but she's looking forward to a warm welcome when she returns to the island later this month. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
There are ways to beat the heat without using more electricity. One's from the Middle Ages. It's called a wind catcher.
Having been outside in the heat and then suddenly going inside and being right under the wind catcher and feeling the cool breeze on you was so mysterious.
That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. 3 years ago this month, the Taliban returned to power in Afghanistan. Since then, the international community has faced a basic dilemma, how to engage with a group that holds some extreme views, especially when it comes to the rights of women and girls. This week, we've been bringing you excerpts from the podcast, The Negotiators. Today, Ashley Jackson, co-director of the Center on Armed Groups, looks at how aid workers and activists have continued to negotiate with the Taliban on the issue of women's rights.
Everything seemed to change overnight when the Taliban came into Kabul.
Vicky Aiken is an aid worker who lived in Afghanistan for nearly 6 years as the country director for the International Rescue Committee. She stayed on throughout the Taliban takeover and saw the chaos of evacuations give way to an eerie kind of calm.
It just got really quiet. No one was quite sure what to expect.
Despite the uncertainty, Vicky felt an obligation to try to keep IRC's operations running.
At that point, I had nearly 2,000 staff. Over 40% of them were women. And I wanted to make sure, if I could possibly do anything, that they would still have a livelihood when we reopened.
NGOs like IRC had been negotiating with the Taliban for years. But it wasn't people like Vicky who were talking to the Taliban. Instead, it would be local Afghan staff, quietly negotiating with fighters and commanders in the villages where they were working. But after the Taliban took over, that changed. Senior aid workers like Vicky had to go directly to the new government.
The United States calls him a global terrorist and offers a $5 million reward for his capture. Yet 1 week,
Vicky's first meeting was with Halil Haqqani, the acting minister of refugees and repatriation.
Halil Haqqani is a leader in the Haqqani network and remains on terror watch lists and under UN sanctions. But now, here in Kabul, after 1 week, he is acting as a diplomat.
As an American and as a woman, I had doubts about what it would be like. And when we walked into the compound, it was filled with Taliban. There were no women anywhere. It was a very cordial meeting.
And from that first meeting, the Taliban ministers were hopeful about the future of their country.
It really felt like there was a lot of openness in the beginning.
In those early days, the Taliban made pledges to continue to allow women and girls to keep working and going to school.
Women will be afforded all their rights, whether it is in work or other activities, because women are a key part of society.
And Vicky says they made good on those promises, at least at first.
I hired 2,000 women after the Taliban took over.
But around the same time, Afghan women's rights activist Mahbuba Siraj had a different first encounter with the Taliban. A group of former soldiers, now security officials, showed up at her office in Kabul.
The first time the Taliban came at 10 p.m. at night to shut me down.
Mahbuba runs domestic violence shelters for women. These were controversial even under the Republic, but the Taliban suspected that these shelters were actually brothels in disguise. Shortly after the Taliban took power, many women's shelters preemptively closed or were forcibly shut by the Taliban. This meant sending the women and children they had been protecting back to abusive homes they had fled. But Mahbuba's shelters stayed open.
And they said, you know, we want to see the shelters. I said, you cannot see the shelters. The shelters are not for men. They said, no, we want to because, you know, we believe this is a bordello or whatever.
But while people like Mahbuba and Vicky were carving out space to work under the new Taliban government, the economy began to collapse, creating a whole host of other challenges to deal with.
We couldn't get money to our staff to pay their salaries. We couldn't get money to the women who needed day-to-day survival money.
That's Masuda Sultan, an Afghan-American entrepreneur. She co-founded one of the largest women's organizations in Afghanistan. At this point, in October of 2021, the problem wasn't the Taliban. It was Afghanistan's financial collapse.
That financial collapse was due to several factors. Donors stopped sending money for healthcare and education. This led to many NGOs pulling out of the country. Then the U.S. froze Afghan assets in overseas banks. But it wasn't just the Taliban government unable to access those accounts. Ordinary Afghans also couldn't withdraw their money. This led to financial hardship for millions of Afghans. Ashley Jackson picks up the story from there.
The Taliban government had announced that schools would reopen for girls on March 23rd. U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan, Tom West, was so confident that it would happen that he helped put in place a deal to pay the salaries of teachers. Not just female teachers, but all teachers.
We had worked with a number of like-minded donors on an essential quid pro quo, and that was to say to the Taliban, if you fulfill this commitment that you've made to your people and to the international community, then we're going to find a way to support 220,000 teachers in their work. And that is about 66% of Afghanistan's civil service.
At the same time, entrepreneur Masuda Sultan was planning her first trip back to the country since the Taliban takeover.
To check on the women that we know and see how their operations are going. And then wouldn't it be great to go when schools reopen so that we could also see girls in school and let them know that we care about them and see how they're doing.
And then this happened.
The Taliban has ordered the closure of middle and high schools for girls in Afghanistan just hours after they were reopened.
The girls had literally just sat down at their desks and the head teacher got a WhatsApp message from the local Taliban in charge saying that actually teenage girls can't come back to class just yet.
The Taliban's sudden reversal means girls above the sixth grade can't go to school until further notice.
The U.S. considered breaking off talks with the Taliban government in protest of this decision. But just 8 days after the announcement, on March 31st, Tom West met with Taliban representatives directly again at a meeting in China.
I think the decision that we faced internally was whether that meeting goes ahead without a country present to express in no uncertain terms what an extraordinarily negative impact this decision was going to have for the potential for Afghanistan's reintegration into the international community of nations. And yeah, it was extremely tense. But I also think that the representatives of the Taliban in the room were not surprised. And frankly, they weren't even particularly defensive.
Abdulkahir Balki, the spokesperson of the Afghan Ministry of Foreign Affairs, was one of those Taliban representatives in the room.
Yes, obviously, the United States was very, I don't want to call it combative, but they were not happy. They did raise that issue, and we did give our explanation of what happened.
Balki gave the Taliban's explanation to the media, too.
Why is it right now that teenage girls in Afghanistan are unable to access secondary education?
There is a mix of reasons. It's not just one or two. It's cultural constraints, it's financial constraints, it's lack of teachers.
Do you know when, though, girls' schools will open?
That is a question that will be answered by the relevant ministries. I don't have the timeline for it.
Entrepreneur Masuda Sultan had a decision to make. Would she go ahead with her planned trip to Afghanistan, the one that was supposed to be timed to coincide with the reopening of schools?
People are so upset, and I'm so upset. And we're thinking, are we going to go to Afghanistan when they just did this? So we got on the phone, and the crystallizing moment for us was when a woman explained, she said, look, I work with a lot of girls. They are very depressed. They're demoralized. They're devastated. And for you to say, we're not coming because they're not allowed to go to school, that's going to make them even more depressed. They want to see you. They want interaction. They need it. Their minds need it. Their hearts need it. And so we said, okay, we're going to go.
They were still really apprehensive. It was Masuda's first trip back to Kabul after the Taliban takeover. And she was worried about whether she would be allowed to even enter the country. But as soon as she saw the girls, she knew she had made the right decision.
The faces of these young teenage girls with so much energy and, you know, these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed girls who are like, we really wanted to go to school. And we, you know, we had our backpacks and our, you know, books and our sharpeners and everything ready. And we're keeping them ready. And we're giving them to other girls, too, because we want to prepare these girls for the day that they're going to go back.
And by going ahead with their trip, Masuda and her group also got the opportunity to meet with the Ministry of Education.
When we went in, yeah, we were angry. And, you know, I thought, these must be really awful people. These must be very cruel human beings.
But what Masuda heard really surprised her.
We believe in girls' education. And we were ready to start the schools, but we were given an order at the last minute. And we were shocked because they were saying, yeah, if the emir tells us today at 11 p.m. at night to open the girls' schools, we're ready to open the girls' schools. The truth was that every single Talib that we met said, we want girls' schools to reopen. We have to work towards that. And people will say in the West and in the U.S. will say, oh, that's just talk. I don't think that the people that we looked in the eye who told us that they wanted the schools for their own daughters are lying to us.
And this was the moment when the outside world began to understand the Taliban in a different way. The Emir Haibatullah Akhundzada, this very secretive figure who hardly meets anyone, emerged as a key decision maker. And he was making increasingly controversial decisions.
you know, we're in this moment of stuck with this, where one person, the emir, has ultimate decision-making power. And they are an organization of people that follow the emir. That is what they do.
An Al Jazeera film crew came with activist Mahbuba Siraj when she met with Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid and begged him to talk sense to the emir. Mahbuba is saying, for God's sake, please open the girls' schools. It is not possible to have a generation that does not go to school. Unless you solve this, Mr. Mujahid, the whole world will stand against you, and therefore the people of Afghanistan will suffer.
And he said that, you know, I don't make those decisions. I said, it's true, but you are the only connection I have right now. You are the spokesperson for that man in Kandahar. Tell him, because this is not only my voice, this is the voice of millions of girls in this country and women. And I had to beg him. I really did.
The meeting ended with Mujahid telling Mahbuba, may God find more mothers like you who force us to give them their rights. Talking to the film crew later, Mahbuba sounded optimistic, believing that maybe if the message got back to the emir, things would get better. But instead, things just got harder. As the international community condemned these controversial decisions, the Taliban responded by doubling down. The restrictions and decrees began rapidly increasing and getting more severe.
They used this girls' schools and education as a weapon for their discussion to win. You don't do this, you don't let us have our representatives in the United Nations, we are not going to let the girls go.
And the Taliban was not alone in this tactic, Vicky Aiken says. The U.S. used it too.
Saying, well, if you're not going to let girls go to school, then we can't engage with you on this, on the economy or on other issues. So then the Taliban started issuing additional decrees. And then each time we're on the verge of getting back on track, something else happens.
This reached a kind of peak in December of 2022.
Christmas Eve, won't forget that.
Taliban has ordered all national and international NGOs to stop their female employees from working. The order from the Economy Ministry threatened to suspend the licenses of NGOs that failed to implement the directive.
So at this point, aid workers like Vicky were frantically trying to get the Taliban to make exceptions and allow their female staff to keep working, which they did pretty successfully. But these were incredibly time-consuming and intense negotiations.
It's not just negotiating in the capital or with the Ministry of Economy. It's negotiating at the provincial level, at the district level, with every single ministry you might encounter along the way. And even then, you know, most of the commitments that you get are verbal. And then it's up to your female staff to make that decision about whether or not they want to continue working.
At the same time, they were also desperately trying to persuade international donors to keep the aid flowing.
Behind the scenes, just the amount of engagement we had to do to convince the international community not to abandon Afghanistan altogether.
Part of the problem was, following the ban on post-primary education for women, Western diplomats like Tom West all but stopped talking to the Taliban government.
I was hopeful that as a consequence of the complete slowdown in engagement, that we would see a reversal of course, and we haven't.
Over the summer of 2023, dialogue between senior U.S. officials and the Taliban-led government picked back up.
They will say it in unvarnished terms. They want to be on good and friendly terms with the United States.
U.S. Special Representative Tom West and Afghan Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Abdul Balki both point to common ground that the two sides can talk about.
I mean, what we hear from the United States is that they're concerned about the security, the narcotics trade, trafficking arms and drugs and human trafficking problems, economy, the banking sector. This is what we hear. Unfortunately, what we see is that despite the progress that we have in those areas, unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any reciprocation from the other side.
What does the Afghan government want from the international community?
That is a question that we've repeatedly posed to the United States, the European countries, and the UN is what do you want from Afghanistan?
One might argue the answer is simple, to let girls go to school. Yet whereas the international community sees female education and the right to work as human rights, the Taliban see this as overreach.
The priorities of the other side is what we deem meddling in the internal affairs of another sovereign country. And if that is what they seek from Afghanistan, obviously then there is no common ground.
In essence, the situation is, once again, at a stalemate, with neither side willing to compromise. All three of the women we spoke to, aid worker Vicky Aiken, entrepreneur Masuda Sultan, and activist Mahbuba Siraj, they all agree that the only way to actually help the women of Afghanistan is through engagement. Here's Vicky.
What do the women of Afghanistan get by their lack of engagement? Nowhere in the Doha Agreement is there a single reference to or safeguard for women's rights. You know, part of that is because they're left out of the conversation. Let's not keep making that same mistake. Where there's any possibility of standing in solidarity with and supporting women and girls in Afghanistan, we have to be here and we have to do that.
And Masuda says there is space to work, even on girls' education.
Yes, there are schools. Some of them are secret, some of them not so secret. You have to make quiet progress, but the best progress is this quiet progress. It's always easy to be a pessimist on Afghanistan because it's so difficult of a place and there's always bad news. But for those of us that work on Afghanistan, we have to always be optimistic because if you're not optimistic and you don't find the places where you can do something to help people, then you may as well pack up and go home and call it a day.
Like Masuda, Mahbuba Siraj says she's optimistic about the future of Afghanistan. She says she has to be.
You know, I'm 75 years old, sweetie, and I don't have a whole lot in front of me. But I will go on till my last breath that I promised to my girls, to myself, and to my God. I'm not going to give in, honey. That's not who I am. That's not who I am. It's my job. It's my responsibility. I'm a woman. I am here. I'm working for Afghanistan, and that's all there is to it. Period.
Mahbuba Siraj ending that excerpt from the podcast, The Negotiators, The Afghan Impasse, an episode hosted there by Ashley Jackson, co-director of the Center on Armed Groups. The Negotiators is a production of Foreign Policy and Doha Debates. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There's a pretty good chance that wherever you happen to be listening right now, you're doing so in air conditioning, whether in your car or at home. Around 90% of Americans nowadays have some kind of AC in their residences. Of course, this presents a problem because AC uses energy and boosting electricity consumption just adds to global warming. But there are ways to beat the heat that don't require electricity. Back in 2022, the world's Diri Buscarin had this report on architects who were looking into medieval techniques to cool off modern buildings.
As a kid, radio producer Seema Gadirzadeh spent her summers in one of the hottest places on Earth, where temperatures regularly reach 115 degrees Fahrenheit, the desert city of Yazd, Iran.
Yazd was always, to me, this mysterious place that had miraculously escaped the process of modernization that has happened in the architecture elsewhere.
The alleys of historic Yazd are lined with thick walls the color of sand, punctuated by the colorful tiled domes of mosques and verdant swaths of trees. In the evenings, her family would gather on the roof for a rosewater and lime dessert called Yazdi Falude. During the day, they'd descend to the lower floors, where a breeze flowed through the house.
Especially when I was around 5 or 7, it started attracting my attention, and I was like, oh my God, what is this phenomenon?
This phenomenon is an old invention called a wind catcher. Boxy and geometric, they take in the cooler, less dusty air from high above the city and push it down into the homes below. They don't need any electricity or mechanical help to do this, just the physical structure of the tower and the laws of nature. Cold air sinks, hot air rises.
Having been outside and the heat, and then suddenly going inside and being right under the wind catcher and feeling the cool breeze on you was so mysterious.
Wind catchers are at least 700 years old, says Nasser Rabat, director of the Aga Khan Program for Islamic Architecture at MIT.
From the 13th century, we have references to the wind catcher.
People wrote poems about the Windcatchers, mentioned them in travelers' diaries, though dating them precisely is hard because homes were constructed with adobe and rebuilt over the centuries. We know that Windcatchers began to appear all over the medieval Muslim world, including in Cairo, where Rabat studied them.
And they are usually extremely simple in form because they're just basically a slanted roof with a screen facing usually in the direction of the favorable wind.
Other Windcatchers grew increasingly elaborate. Homeowners would install intricate screens to keep out the birds. Water features and courtyard pools would bring down the temperature even more.
They would put water jars made out of clay under, and that would cool the air further.
But after World War II, many of the older techniques that kept life comfortable in the Middle East fell out of favor. New York and Beirut-based architect Ziad Jamaldine says many leaders in the Gulf region began to commission European architects to build cities in their image.
Partially demolishing or totally erasing the historic urban dense fabric.
Those shaded walkways created by overhanging interconnected buildings and angled streets.
And what they did is that they substituted it with the gridded urban city we are very much familiar with today, which perhaps, of course, made sense in the cold climate of Western Europe.
But in a place like Kuwait or Abu Dhabi, you need a lot of air conditioning to make it comfortable, not to mention in many other parts of the world. Today, air conditioners and fans make up about 10% of worldwide electricity use, according to the International Energy Agency. This reliance on AC is leaking refrigerant into the atmosphere and contributing to global warming.
I think it's almost criminal.
Sue Rofe is one of the architects trying to design buildings that don't rely on AC for cooling. She's a professor emeritus at the Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, and she recently built her own home in the British countryside using the same principles of ventilation and insulation that she learned while studying the Windcatchers of Yazd.
Let me see, it's 55.6 relative humidity.
Strategically placed windows and thick cave-like walls keep Rofe's home at a cool 69 degrees Fahrenheit.
I have a vertical route up the center of the house, and then there's a roof light, a Velux window in the roof that I open up. So you get the stack effect, drawing cooler air or warmer air through the house.
It's a passion project and a way to show that it's possible to build for a warming world. Yazd today is a bustling modern city, full of motorcycles and high-rise buildings. But Mohamed Bandekoda, a video editor, likes the older parts best. Whenever I'm sad, I go for a walk in the old city, he tells me in Persian. The breeze in the alleys heals you. And although the beauty of the Yazd skyline comes from the Windcatchers, he says, he's never been inside a home with one in use. There's a Windcatcher in my grandmother's house, he says, but no one knows how to open it up anymore. So it just stays there, he says, waiting to be used again. Or to inspire the next generation of climate-conscious builders. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin.
The killing of the Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Iran's capital last month set the Middle East on edge. Israel is widely blamed for the assassination, and Iran has threatened retaliation. Major world powers have scrambled to bring the temperature down in the region. There is a tendency to see situations like this in stark black and white terms. Situated in the middle of these perceptions is the singer, actress, and activist Liraz. Liraz Shahi was born in Israel to Iranian parents in 1978. She's actually played the role of a Mossad spy in the Israeli TV series Tehran. Also, some members of her extended family were killed in a kibbutz on October 7th. Since then, she's been outspoken about her desire for peace in the Middle East. She hopes this tune, Half, can be a conversation starter. The title is Farsi, meaning talk. LaRoz wants to spark a conversation that brings people together as opposed to another thing she sings about, the false narratives swirling around social media and the charged rhetoric that stokes division. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thanks for being with us, and enjoy your weekend.